Welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show on TLSradio.com. That was Girl School playing us in with Race with the Devil. To this week's entirely pre-recorded and pre-assembled show. I'm out playing on a stage currently, so I can't be here to do the show live. So instead, we've assembled some material around an interview I had 3 or 4 weeks back with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about his recent book, The Science Delusion. And the first part of tonight's show is an introduction to Rupert Sheldrake himself, mostly gleaned from the book, and a discussion from the internet, from Rupert Sheldrake's website, between Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's been mentioned on this show before, and Rupert, concerning many things, but especially basically the kind of state of modern science and their realisations regarding it. And then there's a bit of a conversation between myself, Nick M, and Mr. Curative, some initial thoughts on some of the items that are raised during the show as a whole. The second part of the show will include my interview with Rupert Sheldrake after I'd heard him do his talk. So I was able to talk to him about a few things that he doesn't normally talk about, I think, in a public arena. Followed by the rest of the conversation that I had with Mr. Curative. We had a fair few problems with the Skype line, as you'll gather, so there's a bit of jumping around and one or two little discontinuities. There's been a lot of editing done to try to limit those. But in the meantime, here is the first of those bits, really, an introduction to Rupert Sheldrake, followed by the discussion with Dr. Lipton. And the first voice you'll hear in that discussion, the American voice, is that of Dr. Lipton. Rupert Sheldrake is the more English-sounding of the two, so I'll leave you with those two, and they'll be followed up by that first part of the conversation that I had with Mr. C, and I'll be back with you after that. It was my good fortune recently to find myself in the same place as Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, author recently of a book called The Science Delusion, and previously of a book called The New Science of Life. He's a very interesting character, and the New Science of Life is his hypothesis of morphic resonance. He asks, why do many phenomena defy the explanations of conventional biology and physics? You know, when laboratory rats in one place have learned how to navigate a maze, why do rats elsewhere seem to learn it more easily? Rupert Sheldrake describes this process as morphic resonance. The past forms and behaviours of organisms, he argues, influence organisms in the present through direct connection across time and space, calling into question many of our fundamental concepts about life and consciousness. Dr. Sheldrake reinterprets the regularities of nature as being more like habits and immutable laws. He caused a real furore, in fact, with the new science of life, and it provoked outrage amongst the old guard and approbation amongst the new. And the British journal Nature called it the best candidate for burning there's been for many years, and a lively debate, as I'm sure you can imagine, ensued. The science delusion is, I think, possibly even more controversial in its way, even though it has so far attracted absolutely no comment at all, as far as I can gather from the scientific orthodoxy. Anyway, I had a chance to spend 15 or 20 minutes with I'm going to call him Rupert because I have met him a couple of times now, and he's very friendly and a really excellent man to talk to, in fact, because it's the questions you ask get such rich answers. So that's what I'm going to work towards, but I'd like to introduce the man a little bit first, because he has been sidelined, really, because of his revolutionary views. And many of the other scientists I talk to who are quite well established maybe haven't even heard of him. And yet he is, in many ways, one of their number. You know, it's their techniques that he's using, and he's arguing that there isn't a necessity to actually spend an enormous amount of money to find out about how things work in certain key ways, that we just have to apply ourselves to it. So, despite the fact that the methods recommended to do with peer review and published in, you know, peer-reviewed journals and all the other things are adhered to, there's some people, shall we say, just end up on the sidelines. So he studied sciences at school and then at Cambridge University, and he majored in biochemistry. He was awarded a fellowship
in the graduate school at Harvard, and he studied the history and philosophy of science there before returning to Cambridge to do research on development of plants, which is what he concentrated on as a PhD project. And once he got his PhD, he was elected to a research fellowship of Clare College in Cambridge, where he was director of studies in cell biology and biochemistry, teaching students in tutorials and laboratory classes. And then he was appointed a research fellow of the Royal Society and continued his research at Cambridge on plant hormones. We'll hear a little bit about that in one of the pieces I'm going to play. With his colleague Philip Rubery, he's effectively made some of the discoveries that of providing a foundation on which much of the subsequent research on plant polarity has been built. And then, funded by the Royal Society, he spent a year at the University of Malaya studying rainforest ferns, and at the Rubber Research Institute in Malaya, he discovered how the flow of latex in rubber trees is regulated genetically. And then he came back to Cambridge and developed a new hypothesis of ageing in plants and animals, including humans. All cells age. When they stop growing, they eventually die. And his hypothesis is about rejuvenation and proposes that harmful waste products build up in all cells that cause them to age. But they can produce rejuvenated daughter cells by cell divisions in which one cell receives most of the waste products and is doomed, while the other's wiped clean. And this is interesting as well, because we're going to hear in a bit how human beings are effectively exactly like cells. They share all of the same characteristics. Cells work pretty much the same as a whole human does. And the most rejuvenated of all the cells are eggs, and in both plants and animals, two successive cell divisions produce an egg cell and three sister cells, which quickly die. Sheldrake's hypothesis was published in Nature in 1974 in a paper called The Aging, Growth and Death of Cells, and programmed cell death has since become a major field of research, which is important for our understanding of diseases like cancer and HIV, as well as tissue regeneration through stem cells. Many stem cells divide asymmetrically, producing a new rejuvenated stem cell and a cell that differentiates, ages and dies. Sheldrake's hypothesis is that rejuvenation of the stem cells through cell division depends on their sisters paying the price of mortality. Dr. Sheldrake has spent all of his adult life as a scientist, and he says, "I strongly believe in the importance of the scientific approach, yet I've become increasingly convinced that the sciences have lost much of their vigour, vitality and curiosity. Dogmatic ideology, fear-based conformity and institutional inertia are inhibiting scientific creativity." With scientific colleagues, he has been struck over and over again by the contrast between public and private discussions. In public, scientists are very aware of the powerful taboos that restrict the range of permissible topics. In private, they are often more adventurous. He says that he has written The Science Delusion because he believes that the sciences will be more exciting and engaging when they move beyond the dogmas that restrict free inquiry and imprison imaginations. So, that's Dr. Sheldrake. I want to play a little 15-minute excerpt that came from his website, because he said that I could use whatever I found on there to put this show together. And one of the things I found, there's lots of great stuff on there of him doing talks, and more interesting, I think, are where he's actually in dialogue or trialogue with other people, and there's several of those up there as well. And the one I've chosen to excerpt here, as it were, is a talk between Rupert Sheldrake and Dr. Bruce Lipton. Some people who've been listening to the show for a while may remember a while back there was a show when I concentrated a bit on the work of Dr. Lipton. He wrote a book called The Biology of Belief, which was a real groundbreaking classic, in which the first cell biologist on Earth went quantum in his approach to the science that he was studying. And it happened partly because of work that he was doing, I think, way back in 1968, when he was growing stem cell cultures in petri dishes, and he realized that he could clone all of these cells, so effectively they're identical to each other. And he noticed that when he split them into three different pots and changed the nutrients, I think it was, that he fed to these cell cultures, that they form different things. Some of them formed fat and some of them formed bone, and I think the others formed muscle. Forgive me if the details are not quite there, but that was basically the drift of it. And you realise that that means that these identical entities become different, not dependent upon their genes, but entirely dependent on their environment. And of course, this was an intriguing idea which fell very neatly into place with Rupert Sheldrake's idea of morphic resonance, because he too is saying that there are influences coming from outside which cause things to be the way they are, if you like, and something we'll look at in a little more detail in a few minutes. But first of all, this is a piece from 14 or 15 minutes out of the middle of a chat between Rupert Sheldrake and Bruce Lipton. And A, it shows what funny men they are. There's some very amusing dialogue in it, but also it touches critically on several of the illusions, several of the problems that modern science actually has. But there we go. I'll play this one and then come back to you.
Well, when I started to, it was interesting. I was still stuck in the chemical world, and I identified that on the membrane there are these structures called receptors. And there's an interesting parallel here, which we'll talk about again maybe tomorrow, and that is that we are made in the image of a cell, actually. So that if I talk about a cell or I talk about a human, we're still talking about the same thing. So the skin of the cell is very much similar to yours in a sense. It's a boundary that contains the inside, but it also has the ability to read the environment. So as we have eyes and ears and nose and taste and all these other receptors, cells have on them the same things, but in micro form, in a sense. So they're reading the environment. And the truth is, from my second grade image, when I first saw cells, I saw them as sentient beings. I didn't see them as just moving around in the water. They were like the amoeba would go look at something and then back away and then move somewhere else, or the paramecium. So I saw them as people, and it turns out to be, here's a very interesting relation, if you that we'll talk about at some point in regard to fractals, that we are made in the image of the cell. Every function that is in our human body is already present in every cell. Anything you can identify in here is in a cell. It's got digestive, respiratory, excretory, nervous, reproductive system. Every cell even got an immune system. And so the relevance that was really fun for me is that by understanding the nature of what the cells were reading in their environment, it changed their lives. And then I started to recognize this, because I'm cloning these cells in a petri dish, and the simple thing that you've learned right away in culturing cells is sometimes the environment isn't that good when you culture them, and you put the cells into these cultures, and next thing you know, they're sick and dying, and they don't look very good. But I found if you take those cultures and then put them into a better environment, the cells immediately recover, grow, and start to flourish. And then all of a sudden it hit me, I said, oh my goodness, that realize this, that well, we see ourselves as single individual entities. That's a misperception, because the living things are cells. We are communities of cells, about 50 trillion cells, it's been suggested, making us up. Why that's relevant is that in a simple reality, we are like skin-covered petri dishes. And if we put our petri dishes in a good environment, then we flourish and do well. And if we put it in a bad environment, we start to reflect what was going on in that environment, and that we can come back and then get back into a good environment and recover. And why this became important is, for me, it took the emphasis to understand the nature of health and vitality was to look outside of the cell and not look inside the cell, which became to me a physical complement of the world. So the cell becomes a complement of its environment. And so then the issue is, what is that environment? And my conventional teaching only left me in the physical world of molecules and atoms and the material world. And it was at some point after I left my conventional job that I picked up a book by Heinz Pagels called The Cosmic Code. And it was about quantum physics. I had no idea about quantum physics, really, because as a biologist, I was just lucky enough to get through physics in school. And so, but it turned out that I realized that not only myself, but every one of my colleagues was only programmed with what is called Newtonian or, you know, classical physics, which is a world based on material reality. That they didn't understand anything about quantum physics, neither did I. But as I started to read the book, I was totally shocked, because the simple truth is this. Physics is the primal science. If you want to study biology, you got to know physics before you know biology. And I started to go back and I realized not only did I not know it, everyone in my field had no understanding of this physics. And the first thing the new physics said is, it's not the physical reality where the information is. It's in the field, the invisible stuff. And all of a sudden, it was like that jumped me from my mechanical material world idea into entertaining the concept of the invisible force as being more powerful. And then, and what it ultimately brought to me was the concept of spirituality, which I didn't believe in. And I actually got into science to avoid the spiritual stuff. You know, and it's interesting because when you're growing up and you hear these people give all this wonderful spiritual wisdom, and then as a kid you look at their lives, and even as a kid you go, geez, well, you know, that doesn't work for that guy very well, so why should you listen to that? And so I really went into science because I thought that's where I'm going to find all these truths to make sense out of my world. And the joke for me was, when I finally got to the awareness and I was already a tenured faculty member, I realized I was teaching religion as much as I was teaching science. And that's because we were just teaching dogmatic beliefs based on what everybody, you know, like a show of hands. How many people want to believe in this? Oh, that's enough people, so that's a rule. And so the issue about that is that I started to realize is that we were completely misunderstanding the nature of the game. And that you cannot live in this world without understanding first the mechanisms of the quantum mechanics, which is the foundation. And it's kind of weird because that's that weird science. You know, that's the one that it's a particle, it's a wave. How can it be both? And that's the nature of the game. And yet, the moment you bring that science into this field of biology that we're talking about, all the problems that we're really basically facing in the world today start to sort themselves out in much better solutions and resolutions than the mechanical drug pharmaceutical industry answer to the issues. And it's an unfortunate situation because my perception of it now is that this has been perhaps one of the biggest destructive events in biomedicine is their collusion with pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I found that the surprising thing for me was that while in the 20th century physics had become more open, discovering more and more weird things, quantum theory, indeterminacy, you know, all the different wave-particle duality, quantum non-locality, in cosmology, weird phenomena like quasars, now multiple universes, all this stuff was going on. Physics getting broader and broader and stranger. In the same period, throughout the 20th century, biology has gone in exactly the opposite direction. It started broad, and it's got narrower and narrower and narrower, right through the 20th century. As when I was an undergraduate, most biology was still semi-holistic. We still looked at living animals and plants. Not much. Yeah. But, I mean, the first time you brought them into the lab, and they were alive for the first few minutes till you killed them. But they don't even have that now. My son's just been studying biology at school, at high school in England, and in his whole course, it was all molecular biology. They didn't see a single living or dead organism. They don't even dissect things anymore. It's all just learning about molecules. So I think that this extreme reductionist molecular biology thing has got worse, a lot worse, and made biology much narrower. And I saw this when I was, again, a student at Cambridge. I was studying biochemistry, and we had a series of special seminars given by molecular biologists, and I was one of a hand-picked group invited in the evenings to hang out with Francis Crick and Sidney Brenner. Both of them got the Nobel Prize, both of them eminent Cambridge biologists. And they were trying to persuade us, who they thought was this group of promising biochemists, to go into molecular biology. This was in 1963. And they explained their approach, and it was very clear. Francis Crick said, you know, we've figured out the genetic code in 10 years. He said, we've understood the basic key to life in 10 years. There are two basic problems still unsolved, developmental biology and consciousness. He said, the only reason they haven't been solved so far is the people who are studying it just aren't smart enough. He said, I'm taking consciousness, Sidney Brenner's taking developmental biology, and we'll have it figured out in 10 years in molecular terms. They believed this. It was a kind of evangelical crusade. They then persuaded grant-giving agencies, and later in the 70s and 80s, beginning then, investment companies to invest huge amounts in molecular biology, promising that sequencing the genome, the genetic modification of plants, all this kind of thing, would lead to huge profits. And the Human Genome Project was invented as a political move. The biologists have always suffered from physics envy. And there was a debate in the early 80s about physics has got big science, multi-billion dollar projects like atom smashers, colliders, and so forth, as well as all the stuff they had, space programs. Biology was still a kind of cottage industry. So they wanted some big project that would capture the imagination, that you could explain. It had to be something you could explain to President Reagan. Well, that limited your... that limited the possibilities. They came up with the Human Genome Project. You know, it's big, it's human, it's a multi-billion dollar, it's the kind of thing that would be a milestone in history. You know, it had all the right things. It was a smart move. It then meant there was a huge amount of money, billions of dollars invested in it. Then this led to biotech companies and all sorts of... And if you have hundreds of billions of dollars invested in molecular biology, that means there's lots of jobs. If there's lots of jobs, universities have to train people for those jobs. And it swung the entire balance of biology right over to the molecular side. Universities, many of them hardly do any other biology now. So this was, I think, a deliberate thing with market forces going along with it that has led to this tremendous distortion of biology in this reductionist direction. Of course, the Human Genome Project turned out to be a big disappointment. I mean, they were expecting that we'd all have by now, you know, individualized medicine, all sorts of enormous benefits were supposed to flow. They didn't. And when the genome was finally sequenced, you know, the private genome company, Celera Genomics, that was going to patent hundreds of human genes and make lots of money out of patenting genes, headed by Craig Venter, in 2000, their shares were trading at about $230 a share. Within a few months, they were about $8 a share. They're now $7 a share. And when people actually saw the results, and when there was a tremendous anticlimax, a tremendous sense of disappointment. And I read an interview with Craig Venter, who at least has a good sense of humor. He said, "I'm a guy that's made a million the hard way by working my way down from a billion." So I think that this enormous boom in molecular biology leading to a tremendous distortion of the whole of biology might actually be coming to an end because it's running into the ground. And one reason I think this is that molecular biologists are now drowning in data. They've sequenced not just the human but dozens of other genomes. There are computer databases stacked with these huge amounts of information. It's now easy to buy machines that do this. Every issue of Nature and Science, the leading international journals, are crammed with full-page ads for sequencing machines, molecular biology, chemicals, and so forth. They just don't know what to do with it. Now they think that by hiring computer experts and calling it bioinformatics, that somehow the answer will appear. But actually, the more smart guys in that field are realizing that just piling up detailed molecular data isn't going to work.
It was a real interesting, to me it was not a disappointment, it was a total failure of the system for this reason. That a very interesting point because Paul Silverman, one of the architects of the Human Genome Project, wrote, and I didn't know it myself because I was caught up in the field thinking, the Human Genome Project sounds like a good humanitarian kind of thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then I read what it was principled on, and it was really created by venture capitalists. Yeah. And the reason for it was this. They anticipated that they were going to make a list of all the genes in a human body, and so that any defect that anybody would ever have would be connected to a gene, and if they could identify every one of these genes, then that everyone would be like a new drug, that they could use to treat anybody's particular illness. And when the project got off the ground, the venture capitalists were all excited because according to the model, it would take over 100,000 genes, maybe 150,000 genes to make a human. And of course, the venture capitalists, that's 150,000 new drugs. That's why everybody jumped on the bandwagon. They were going to patent them all. In fact, I think they have patented most all of the gene segments at this point. But the failure was, and they didn't talk about it, which is always a fun part, when the results came in, there ends up to be about 21,000 genes. And why this is relevant is that some of the smallest animals on this planet have about the exact same number of genes. And so the reality, there was no difference between men and worms in this regard. And it really pulled the big, it just blew the bubble up because it was all, as you said, all the plans. As soon as we have this list of genes, we're going to be able to fix everybody and anybody. And then the issue was not only were there 120,000 missing genes, but then they were complete void as how can you make a human with only 21,000 genes? There was nothing even in their thinking box of where you had to get way out of the box to try to figure out how could you make a human with this. And the issue is when you put this much money into something, it's like a steamroller going downhill, gaining this momentum, you pass the finish line that says, okay, you lost the race, and yet the power of this thing is just pushing on, and we're still buying the same story if you pick up the newspapers about, oh, a gene that controls this and a gene that controls that, as if like nothing ever happened. It's like same story, it just ignore the results. And the reality is you cannot ignore the results. But there's so much money, as you said, in that genetic industry that they're trying to keep this thing afloat, and yet the model is gone.
Yes.
The model is completely gone.
I think that something that also boosted this was the whole ideology of the selfish gene. You know, Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, came out in 1974, and it portrayed genes as selfish, ruthless, competitive. In fact, it perfectly fitted sort of Thatcherism. And this kind of right-wing, competitive, selfish type politics that glories competitiveness and aggression and stuff. And I think that also helped this process along because it gave a kind of ideological underpinning.
Yeah, the thing about these two guys is that I think they're really entertaining. You know, they're easy to listen to. They're obviously human beings, and it makes the science, I think, more attractive and more listenable to. But also, they've both published a lot of papers. They've had a lot of peer review. They've come up with their own hypotheses and all of that. And yet they're talking really openly about, although science is acknowledged to kind of turn out lots of useful stuff, and that comes out of their chat as well. What they're effectively saying is that the science that we found ourselves with in the Newtonian world, you know, is really completely not doing its job. And I was just struck by how many fizz and how many ideas came up just in the kind of half hour chat I've listened to, which are actually completely in line with the sort of stuff we find ourselves talking about. I mean, in one of the bits, we'll hear Sheldrake talk about dogmatic ideology, fear-based conformity, institutional inertia. We hear them talking about the private versus the public attitudes. We hear them talking about massive investment in projects that achieve nothing, whereas just on Monday I was listening to Gary's show about MMS, and now we've got a kind of a really simple substance that seems to do lots of things for lots of people and cost presumably practically nothing. So I'm hoping to explore these kind of more general ideas and use the scientists, if you like, as a springboard for talking about
matter to be doing multiple shows on.
Yes. Well, there's plenty more. I mean, I think that I don't want to go into Sheldrake's scientific creed in any detail, but one or two of the things in it should arise just as a matter of the discussion itself.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a major contributory part for my mind of Sheldrake's ever-increasing insistence about the validity of this consciousness field is very important these days. You know, despair staring you in the face in so many quarters, it's
Yeah, it's true. Well, yeah. there's a couple of things that I think are really important about that. One of them is this idea that the morphogenetic field, or the thing that's helping to give us form, actually refers constantly back and forwards in time. So it's like the experiments in quantum physics have suggested, it's not, you don't have to be local in time or place to something for your system to know and understand it. And the way Sheldrake describes this kind of field, if you like, is that it's more like a habit, say, than an embedded rule. And so he describes it as having attractors that are things in the future which kind of draw it towards a result towards which it's been drawn before. And also, it's got all the experience of every other, you know, similar creature that's travelled through that path. So he likens that to a ball running down a given path, say, on a slightly soily slope. And if you constantly run ball after ball or bearing after bearing down this slope, it'll kind of erode its own little passage. So there's a kind of historical precedent actually driving the system from within, which is full of all the information that's ever happened. And it's reaching forwards to an attractor, which likewise has always been in the field, but it varies as new experience comes on board. So he actually suggests that whilst physical development happens forwards in time, he's suggesting quite clearly in the science delusion that mental or emotional developments are reaching into the quantum sea of potential and bending that sea of potential to the ideas that are being expressed, which obviously gives us all a tremendous say in what happens next.
Yes, I mean, he's very convincing with it too, you know, the fact that you're not going to read this in many a peer-reviewed journal doesn't detract from the fact this guy is very logical in his thought processes and the experiments he references. You know, he's the one that's come closest to convincing the scientific community about the validity of the 100th monkey syndrome, which has been poo-pooed for a long time now by mainstream science.
Yes, it's true. I mean, that's the thing, though, is that the mainstream, like we hear him talking about Dawkin, and saying that he actually quotes him as saying that he's not interested in evidence, that he's actually just maintaining a dogma. And Sheldrake's work with plants appears to have, well, in fact, I mean, like Dr. Lipton says, it's if we allowed this material into the genuine scientific, you know, financed and supported scientific orthodoxy, then many, many of the problems that appear to be facing us just dissolve.
Yeah, absolutely. The interview that you conducted, which actually that's going back a bit now. When did that actually occur?
I think I did that about 3 or 4 weeks back. It happens that in the place that I'm staying, Rupert Sheldrake is a friend of the people who live here. So he came to kind of open up the Willow Theatre for the year with a talk on the science delusion.
That's right.
So that was, I think, probably sort of somewhere towards the end of April. And it was really great to be able to listen to him talk, because as I said to you when I was first talking about this, the book, The Science Delusion, is based on, he has a sort of scientific creed where he makes sort of, states 10 things that material science claims to believe, such as that all mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works, and that unexplained phenomena like telepathy and many others, of course, are illusory. And then he goes on to spend a chapter of each of the book examining each of these 10 creeds, some of which I've no doubt we'll get onto, and examining them in detail in terms of the evidence as not only presented by his own investigations, but as presented by other, you know, peer-reviewed scientists. And really, he kind of nails it down so thoroughly. At the end of each chapter, he poses 4 difficult questions on the particular subject to the materialist scientists. So there's 40 questions in the book that would, that are deserving of an answer, in my opinion. The amazing thing is that he's received no reviews from Nature or from Science or from any of them.
Well, you say amazing, you know.
Well, the, yeah, indeed. Yeah, indeed. I think in a way it is indicative of some kind of victory though, because previously, as both you and I know, it's not just Sheldrake, but any scientist, no matter how well acclaimed previously, who decides to step outside the orthodoxy and challenge it, then they become sort of, sidelined, as it were. They become pariahs. Well, the thing is that is done by finding weak parts in their arguments sometimes, but most often it's just done by simply making their information look discredited, isn't it? And
yeah.
And really, one of the amazing things about this book is that he's attracted no negative criticism. So it seems to me that he's managed to tackle them on several of the key bases and at the same time present them with no targets to have a go.
The call keeps dropping, I think.
All right, well, that's certainly going to make it a little more adventurous, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm just looking at the Skype call quality. Right, so now all of a sudden everything's... Now I'm actually looking at the connection details. Everything's tickety-boo.
Oh, that could be used as an argument for exactly what we're talking about, couldn't it? Because I gather that the Institute of Noetic Sciences is doing research into, you know, whether praying for people or putting giving them hands-on medicine works. And I remember reading that they've apparently found that it definitely works, you know, with patients that they're treating right now. But apparently these things work even if you apply them to sets of data that have not previously been examined.
It's a challenging concept to get one's head around if you're not bringing into play the morphogenetic field, as Sheldrake refers to it as. Kind of all makes sense when you look at it from that perspective, but it is a bit of a quantum leap for a lot of people, most people.
One of the things that perhaps needs looking at a little bit, just because not everybody will be used to terms like reductionist materialism, is for us to recognise where Sheldrake starts from, really, which is that hoping to find out how a system works by looking at it in ever smaller and smaller bits doesn't seem to be paying off.
Valid comment. So I'm just making some Skype adjustments here.
Yeah. And yet he points out that his son, who's just done a biology, degree, doesn't see any whole creatures at all. He's quite amusing on the subject. So, and yet we seem to be ever more ignoring the fact that, like, critters are going extinct all around us and just looking to find out what's going on in smaller and smaller bits. But, like, one of the things I like about Sheldrake is he's got all these experiments that are pretty low cost to do. So he did write a book called Do Dogs Know Their Owners Are Coming Home? Or that's a paraphrase of it. And he's shown quite conclusively, you know, that absolutely is the case, that the dog as a whole organism is quite interesting to study. And, you know, I go from the idea of whether dogs know their owners are coming home, and quite demonstrable evidence that they do, to things like the fact that homeopathy appears to work well on animals. Have you had any experience of that?
Absolutely. I mean, sadly, we lost our cat of 17 years recently, but had many an opportunity to witness firsthand the speed and effectiveness that homeopathy has to offer the animal world. You know, they seem to resonate with it more so than humans do, and therefore the effect is, in my experience anyway, much faster, much, much faster.
Yeah, but, I think that there's, once again, there's plenty of evidence, scientific evidence, if you like, that would back that kind of claim up, and that...
Yeah, there is nowadays. I mean, it wasn't that far back in our past a small stride, in all honesty, where science was still refuting everything that they could. But now, as you quite rightly say, science is now not just agreeing with the elusive effect of homeopathy, but now starting to show how it's producing that effect, or allegedly how. It's all still groundbreaking stuff.
Yeah. In one of the bits that I don't actually get to play from Rupert's website, he talks about the idea of having a very simple experiment. Everybody, he says, acknowledges that the placebo effect takes place. Everybody acknowledges, you know, it's included in all the experiments. But he's suggesting, why don't we just let anybody who wants to have a go or claim or is making claims that they can heal or affect a disease to enter a study where people get randomly allocated to one or other of these, what would be a myriad, I'm sure, of approaches. I mean, imagine what would happen if they did a genuinely open one for cancer, for example.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and from that, from a very simple statistical sweep over that initial experiment, you could get a lot of really practical, useful information. But you're effectively doing that, aren't you, by examining the whole system, by examining the whole human and how it responds to something that's put into it.
Well, yeah, you know, you're starting to invest time, energy and resources into an area of science which stands to yield the answers to some eon long asked questions. But it's difficult to keep mainstream science's attention focused on these matters. You know, Sheldrake's website, for your listeners, sheldrake.org has online and offline tests you can be a part of.
Yes, I really like that aspect of his work, because he's also interested in whether people know that they're being stared at. For example, he's been running extensive examination of that for some time now.
Well, yeah, you know, I had this very conversation just a few nights ago with Midrin, who's ex-police, and his area of speciality was actually surveillance. And he's absolutely certain that that effect is genuine, because in the number of times he was zoomed in, literally on the back of someone's head, not through any weapon, of course, we're talking purely surveillance purposes here, that he could see quite clearly that they were... something was attracting their attention to look round and examine the landscape as though they knew they were being observed right at that moment.
I think that's one of the reasons why his investigations into that have been so extensive, is because he found out some time ago that there appeared to be some evidence for it, and he's sort of refining his techniques as he goes along. And of course, giving the world access to a website where they can have a go at the experiment and feed their own input in is, I think, is great, seeing something put out into the commons. I think there's another one up there on whether people can guess who's going to phone them on a mobile phone. You know, I think...
Yeah. Telepathy.
That's right, yes.
Telephone telepathy.
Yeah. And, of course, it ties in with... because that's this idea that anything like telepathy or on the part of dogs or humans and stuff is just illusory until materialist science can pin it down. But basically the difference, I think, between these experiments and the reductionist ones, just so that people can have a clearer picture, is that one lot's looking at the whole system and seeing how it behaves in the world and how it responds to things. And the other one is detecting ever smaller units of stuff to look at, and then looking only at those units of stuff. It's not actually any more even looking at the behaviour of anything bigger than an organ, as far as I can tell.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the case, and I'm really glad that you are bringing more attention to Sheldrake, well, and Lipton for that matter, who, kudos on you to that. But what for you would you say is the most practical thing that listeners can take away from the interview and the awareness of this man's work?
I think that one of the things is that this practical investigation by individuals. It's not just that, you know, you sort of help out Sheldrake's experiments by getting on his website. It is, if you like, the fact that people's attentions are effectively being drawn to the fact that they can make a difference, that they can look into the world for themselves, and that really with no funding, you can start to find out a little bit about how this other world might look. And one of the important things about that, I think, is that it affects your choices. I mean, I had Paul Anthony Taylor on last week talking from the RAF Foundation about cellular nutrition, about the fact that it's the health of the cells that's important, if you like.
And absolutely. Good interview, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And it's for, to me, these things are all tied together. What Rupert Sheldrake's doing is, if you like, putting a bit of, and Bruce Lipton for that matter, they're putting a bit of flesh on the bones of the kind of ideas. It's not just where we seek our health. Because like Paul said, these blood tests that admittedly cost several hundred pounds and so are probably out of the reach of many people who might otherwise benefit from them. Nonetheless, everybody is still making a choice as to where they spend their money and what they spend their money on. So more people could choose to do that if they were made aware that it might make a difference. And he also pointed out that in his experience, one of the biggest, blockages, one of the biggest preventers of people taking advantage of the new information on health is the fact that they haven't heard it before because of the media. So by putting on people like Sheldrake and Lipton, and then by talking about the ideas raised, if in many people's minds, in the odd person's mind, we might just be generating the idea for the first time that this is worth taking seriously. And in the minds of people who are already taking it seriously to a greater or lesser degree, you give them, if you like, more evidence, a little bit more of a cerebral understanding as well, because I think that comprehension is almost as important as intuition, or they go hand in hand, if you like. This business of the health of the cells being important is also interesting, because it seems to me that whilst looking at ever smaller and smaller units of biology doesn't seem to be paying off, what is happening in the process is that several useful things are occurring. So I think it's Dr. Lipton who points out that the human being is effectively a giant cell, in the fact that the cell itself has senses. It's got its own kind of receptors that are effectively eyes and ears and nose. It's sensitive to all of the things going on around it. It's got a digestive system. It's got a respiratory system. It's got an immune system. All of these things are like organisms. And then we've got Paul Taylor saying that's the level at which, if you feed things properly at that micro level, then the larger thing forms itself more beneficially, as it were.
Just a reminder that you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tlsradio.com. We've been listening to Bruce Lipton speaking with Rupert Sheldrake and myself speaking with Mr. C about some of the things that are being raised about the state of modern science. The next part of the show is a short interview that I had with Rupert some 3 or 4 weeks back, followed by the remainder of the conversation that I had with Mr. C, and this time we're joined by Midrin as well. So that'll take us more or less to the end of the show. There'll be a bit more music, and perhaps I'll be back with you then. See how much time I've got left. Thanks very much for coming to talk to me, Rupert. I really appreciate that. I've already talked a little bit about some of your very perceptive comments on materialist science, but I was particularly taken by a phrase you used, promissory materialism. Can you say a few words on that for me?
Yes. Well, the phrase comes from Sir Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, and he used it years ago because he was struck by the fact that whenever materialists were told their explanation wouldn't work, you know, you can't really explain the mind in terms of the brain, the answer would always be, we agree we can't, but it's just not yet. You know, give us another 10 years, another 20 years, and we'll be able to do it. And Sir Karl Popper noticed that this is such a frequent pattern with materialists. He coined this phrase, promissory materialism, because what materialists do is, in effect, issue undated promissory notes for future explanations. So they agree we can't explain all of life in terms of genes or molecules or minds in terms of brains, or in fact almost anything that they claim that materialism explains can't actually be explained. They agree about that, but they just say, oh well, look at all the triumphs of science, so many things have happened no one would have thought possible, it's just a matter of time and we'll soon explain it all. So that is essentially promissory materialism. I encounter it all the time. But its promises are wearing thin, and the promissory notes have now been so devalued through being reissued with ever more promises that there's a kind of debasing of the currency. And I have a section in my book called The Credibility Crunch for Materialism, because I think that the failure of these promises over and over again is now pretty evident.
So it's, as in so many other places, it's a question of jam tomorrow, perpetually.
Perpetually, yes.
And another thing that that interested me was, I mean, we talked a bit about materialism, but was was an earlier idea of vitalism, wasn't it? One that was a kind of couple of stages back.
Yes.
Can you explain vitalism?
Well, yes. Vitalism grew up after the mechanistic revolution. In the 17th century, Descartes was the first to say that animals and plants were just machines. The whole universe was a machine. Living organisms were just machines, like made of inanimate matter, like everything else, and essentially unconscious, purposeless. The only purposes and designs they had were imposed by an external designing God, but they themselves had no purposes or designs or life or consciousness. So what the vitalists did was, starting in about, I suppose, the 18th century, was to say, no, living things aren't just machines, there's something else about them, a vital spirit, a vital function, a vital spark, vital energy, or some living principle that's over and above the machinery. And they made, I think, a very good case. But the problem is that what they said was that, okay, everything that's not a living organism is just mechanical. It's only living things that have this special extra something. They couldn't quite say what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with that is that if one looks at the whole of nature, it's not obvious that mechanistic science could even explain non-living things, you know, like the Earth. If the Earth is a living organism, Gaia, then that doesn't come under vitalism, because that was only about biological things. So I think vitalism was right. I think it was along the right lines, but it was too limited. And the main alternative to vitalism today is not mechanism, but organicism or holism. And holism says that the nature is made up of organisms at all levels of complexity. Even atoms are a kind of organism, and stars and solar systems and galaxies. So we don't need to confine the need for some extra organizing principle just to living things. Everything needs something more, some holistic principle, emergent systems property, or, as I would put it, morphic field with a kind of memory. So I think vitalism was a step in the right direction, but didn't go far enough.
And the kind of step further is really something akin to the animism that we still see in India, isn't it, where everything has a moving spirit within it?
Yes. I mean, basically, organicism or holism is animism. It's basically saying that everything has some kind of organizing principle which gives it purpose and its integrity. So it is a form of animism. It's treating nature as alive as opposed to dead and mechanical.
And that's quite an exciting idea, I think, because holism, of course, is quite a sophisticated presentation of the animism idea, with the work that Carl Pribram and people have done on that as a structure for the whole system.
Yes, it's our ancestors in the Middle Ages were animists. They were Christian animists who thought that the universe was a living organism. And this is now a post-mechanistic animism, and it's a higher turn of the spiral. It's not turning the clock back, because we have all the insights of modern science which are incorporated into it. But it is a new level of animism.
So we can already see the kind of direction of progress we're likely to find out of the materialist dead end, then, really?
Oh, yes. I think it's already quite clear the way forward. I mean, it's quite clear to a lot of people. I think it's clear to a lot of people who've come to it through the Green Movement or through various alternative movements. It's clear to people who've come to it through a kind of sense of connection with nature, a kind of mystical connection with nature, direct experience of nature, including some people who've had arrived at this through psychedelic experience, mushrooms and so on. And I think it's coming out of science too, because there's been a movement towards this new animism within science and philosophy since the 1920s. Alfred North Whitehead was the main philosopher of this new animism or organic view of nature. And the Gaia hypothesis is just another step in that direction.
Yeah, so there appear also to be many paths leading to this.
Yes, including alternative and complementary medicines, because many of those come out of animistic cultures and traditions. In fact, the only tradition in the world that's not really animistic is the mechanistic one since 17th century in Europe, that says nature's a machine, not an organism. Almost all traditional medical systems come out of a holistic or animistic system of thought.
Yeah, and yet at the other end, the mechanists, as you point out, they have to kind of infuse their theories with a kind of vitalism. And there's a quote, I think, this is partly you and partly you quoting Dawkins, you say one form of molecular vitalism is to treat the genes as purposive entities with goals and powers that go far beyond those of a mere chemical like DNA. And you point out that Dawkins says that DNA moves in mysterious ways, that selfish genes mould matter and engage in evolutionary arms races and aspire to immortality. I was wondering, with that kind of a character and personality that he's giving the genes, whether you might like to say a little thing about the Acetabularia mediterranea, one of the particularly interesting plants that you bring up in the book.
Yes. Well, Dawkins, his whole rhetoric of the selfish gene is essentially vitalist rhetoric, without him realising it. He's a crypto-vitalist. I mean, the entire pace of persuasive power of Dawkins' argument is because he endows the genes with life and purpose and mind. And that's exactly what mechanistic science is supposed to deny. So he smuggles back these vital principles into genes. Somehow it's all right to have vital principles as long as you imagine them as located inside molecules, because molecules sound scientific. But genes, in fact, don't have any of these properties and can't have them. So the genes are simply part of a larger organized system, but it's not as if the genes can be purposive and direct the whole organism like vital spirits or entelechies. Mm. There's this large cell, 5 centimetre long, 2 inch long, single-celled alga called Acetabularia, which has a little root and a long stalk and then a round cap at the top. And it only has one nucleus, it's a single cell. The nucleus is in the little root protrusions.
So the rest of the plant has no DNA in it?
No nuclear DNA. There might be mitochondrial DNA in the mitochondria or chloroplast, but the nuclear DNA is all in this little rhizoid. Now, if you cut the thing off, chop the top of the stem, and you've just got a top of stem and a cap, or just a bit of stem with no cap at all, it turns out it can regenerate. It grows a new cap, and even the stem grows longer. And that has no genes in it, no nuclear genes, no nucleus, showing that the development of this form is not simply molded or shaped by the genes. There's a formative principle, which I call a morphogenetic field in all living things. And that's what shapes form, not the genes. The genes enable it to make proteins. And these things survive for weeks without a nucleus, but in the end they die because they need to make new proteins, and without the nucleus they can't. So they don't live forever, but they can undergo the whole of this regenerative process without genes, without a nucleus.
So it might be that DNA serves rather than guiding the growth to repairing broken down parts, perhaps?
Well, we know what DNA does. It codes for the sequence of amino acids in proteins, so it enables organisms to make proteins, which are building materials and enzymes and so forth. But it's like having the right building materials at a building site. You can deliver bricks and cement and timber to a building site, but that doesn't explain the shape of the building.
Mm-hmm.
It simply gives you the building materials. Without the building materials, you can't make the building.
Yeah.
So the DNA is necessary for making the right proteins. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Acetabularia, it's able to recycle the ones it's already got and regrow. without making many new proteins or any, but then in the end it needs the nucleus.
Yes,
after several weeks. But and we already know that the DNA codes for proteins and doesn't program formal development. That's a kind of fantasy projected onto it. What we know it does is code for the sequence of amino acids and proteins. It's quite a restricted role.
Yeah, I think it has been shown as well, hasn't it, that denucleated cells will in fact kind of divide for a given number of times even without nuclear DNA.
Oh yes, you can do that with sea urchin embryos. You can take the nucleus out and the denucleated cell will start undergoing embryonic development. Yes.
So that's a pretty fundamental argument for Mr. Dawkins to address, really.
Well, he's not very interested in fundamental arguments or addressing them. He simply carries on with his rhetoric.
Yes.
Regardless.
Yes. I think you quote him at some point in the book saying, "I'm not interested in evidence."
That's right, yes. He's in areas that go against his beliefs, like telepathy and so on, he simply doesn't want to know.
Just like a slide response from an uninformed person who's just got confused ideas about science.
Well, he's an ideologue. I mean, he has an ideology, and that's his job, to kind of propagate a materialist atheist ideology. He's a kind of evangelist for materialism. He doesn't really pay that much attention to the details of science anymore. He did, no doubt, once upon a time.
Yes, indeed. That's very interesting, I think, that entities can effectively maintain themselves for a given length of time on the resource that they have within them, and effectively they're reaching outside themselves for their reality into this morphic field.
Well, yes, I mean, the field is inherited by what I call morphic resonance, and it's influenced by the past forms of previous organisms of the same kind. So each organism draws on a kind of collective memory through morphic resonance.
Yeah, fascinating that. And there's another, it's a single-celled organism, I think, called Stentor, that you bring into the book, that also fascinated me because it's effectively a single-celled entity, but it has very complex behaviour patterns.
Yes, it can learn. And the simplest form of learning in all organisms is habituation, which means getting used to things. And if you tap it with a glass rod or something, it'll contract into its case. It's got the whole cell contracts into a little, like a bit like a shell or a case, a tube, and then it expands again. But if it's a harmless stimulus, it just pays less and less attention until it gets used to it. It learns to avoid it. But if you give it a noxious stimulus, the next time it contracts harder, and after a few times it gets fed up with this and just detaches itself from its base and swims away and sets up somewhere else.
Which I thought was great. I really didn't expect it to do that. That was a lovely bit of the book once it's had enough of it. And that is the opposite of habituation, which is sensitization.
That's right. And this is a cell being a single cell without a nervous system.
Yes.
So what this shows us is that learning and memory, because these are simple forms of learning and memory, that don't depend on a nervous system. I mean, this organism doesn't have a nervous system, and yet it can learn and remember.
And it also sort of, when it isn't being disturbed, it sits there pulsing gently and creating little vortices around itself.
Yes, it has cilia, little hairs that beat, creating currents around itself to sweep bacteria and other food matter into its mouth. It has a part where it engulfs things and digests them.
So that's kind of like at the very bottom end of the tidying up mechanism as well. It's kind of doing the sort of thing that slugs do. It's eating up stuff that's around the place.
Yes. And, yes.
Well, that's really great. Thank you very much, Rupert. I think that was very informative.
Good. My pleasure to talk.
And with you.
Absolutely. I mean, even outside of Sheldrake's sphere, there's a lot of, or a growing amount of supporting evidence. This big meditation experiment that they've repeated quite a number of times now, each time they do it, with a view to lowering the amount of hostile acts in a given area. Every time these experiments have been carried out, shall we say, coincidentally, there has been an immediate drop in violent crime statistics in every area that these experiments have been carried out, outside any normal pattern that can be seen from looking at the statistics themselves. So yeah, I'm more than happy to have the potential for what Sheldrake is switching us on to. More than happy. And this is the time for people to be becoming aware of this, I think. You know, 2012, for goodness sake.
Yes, and a sort of change in consciousness is what we're promised, and we're now starting to see the kind of mechanics by which that might occur. And I remember hearing a similar tale. I heard a senior police officer on radio, on a Radio 4 programme of all places, talking about how he'd been looking after a certain part of Liverpool for a given number of years, and some transcendental meditation people started making use of a church hall. And this police officer said that there was a noticeable fall in crime of more or less all sorts for some considerable distance around the hall.
Yeah.
And so the... I think, and it's not only obviously Sheldrake that's suggesting that intent or that our state of mind makes a difference, it's actually the fact that modern physical theory backs that idea up, that the very setting up of an experiment, what it's set up to measure, changes the behaviour of the particles or whatever that are being observed.
Yeah, absolutely. The famous photon experiments, you know, the shooting the photons through the slots should generate an interference pattern that can be extrapolated beforehand. But what the experiment seems to show is it's the simple act of measuring the experiment that affects its outcome. The interesting thing to me in all this, you know, is in relation to December 21st, 2012, which people more in tune with their arithmetic than me believe that the argument about the dates being hundreds of years out and whatnot have been calculated and adjusted to fit in with the Mayan calendar to confirm that sometime around December 21st, 2012 will be the end of a long period of time in which history allegedly carries confirmation of a significant change in the conscious life around at the time. It's been upgraded. You know, the fossil records back up the loss of a lot of predatory type animals and the arrival or the appearance of a more thought-based type of life that's currently us. And the idea goes that we're about to reach the end of our evolutionary period where part of humanity at least will experience this DNA upgrade that will elevate us into the next stage of life in the morphogenetic field.
Yes, which we're already physically equipped to deal with, because we know that only a tiny percentage of our DNA is currently operational or being used, and that the same is true of our mental faculties, of our brain. We're only using a tiny, tiny proportion of those. So it seems to me that it's not unreasonable to anticipate that a move from a materialist science, which is largely enslaved to corporations and only looking at levels of things that can't really give us any useful information, to a system where we realise that the thoughts of every human are important, and that actually we're living in an anecdotal world, not a clinical one.
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent analogy, actually. You know, if you're aware of the fact that your own thoughts are affecting life around you, you know, yours included, but also your interaction with others, it rapidly dictates the need for society to learn to get along, you know, lessen the likelihood of manifesting a particularly vicious thought, and things are improving the instant.
Are you still there?
Yes, we're still here, Nick. Sorry, is it dropping in and out again?
It's dropping in and out at this end. I don't know what it sounds like from your end. I mean, that last thing we were saying about your own kind of personal experience and outlook being important, it's, I guess, not only the way we think about the world, but what happens to the people around us. So, you know, when we do find a friend of ours encountering an alternative medical technique that actually works for them after years of basically finding things. Thought to be, you know, just an unsubstantiated rumour, which is the way we're taught to think about things that haven't been scientifically proven, that sort of stuff becomes real for people and can make a lot of difference then to a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, you know, we're talking paradigm shifting material here, and I don't think anything short of a paradigm shift is going to get us out of the construct that we now exist in.
Is it not the case that we're surrounded by this, for want of a better word, this field of potential? And going back to what you were saying before, when you actually take the measurement, that's when you fix it, and then that measurement's been taken, and that has to fit in with all previous history, and then everything from that point on has to fit in with what's been recorded. And it is the fact of recording it that picks one particular path.
Yes, that's right. And I think that what Sheldrake's suggesting, and he's not the only one, that I think that there were other people before him, is that our reality, to a greater or lesser extent, sorts itself out like that. That you're kind of reaching into the future potential, and it's that conscious attention, it's that consciousness sort of looking, seeking, measuring or observing, whatever you want to call it, that is responsible for the moulded events that occur as a result.
Yeah, you know, an interesting look at this is that the majority of, well, certainly Eastern meditative practices are designed to get you to a state of nothingness, really. And in a state of nothingness, you're not going to be looking to manifest a materialistic, beneficial future. So the thought that our thoughts, whether they're negative or positive, perhaps manifest our future experiences for us just based on how we're thinking, when you compare it to that meditative state of reaching this nothingness, are we then doing something wrong by wanting to positively manifest something in our future as opposed to trying to reach this state of nothingness, which I guess is the melding back into the field, if you like?
I guess, yeah, and becoming... The thing is that I think one way of looking at it is that we're told that our kind of current waking consciousness is about as sleepy as we get, and that if you go into dream-filled sleep, you're becoming more conscious, and that when you're having deep sleep with no dreams, you're at about the closest to conscious that you're ever going to be. And obviously it's becoming clear to all of us, isn't it, that so much of what happens to us because we believe certain things and because we've adopted certain habitual practices, and that as soon as we stop those habits or start trying to readdress them, then everything starts changing really radically. I mean, not just with the way you respond to people on the curbside, but when you change your diet, sometimes when you change your friends, just all manner of things change about you, and it becomes quite clear that personally, our personal experience is that the way we think and what we do changes what happens to us.
Yeah, it's self-evident if you can give yourself long enough to stop and think about it.
we're kind of kept so tied up with visions from outside and machines and jobs and all the things that we perceive are necessary that we possibly not even seeing the grossest of hints coming at us from our environment, let alone the subtle ones.
Absolutely, yeah, that sits nicely with me. You know, we've had generations worth of the belief that we're evolving as things should be, and technologically we're reaching a state of almost godlike status, yet on this inner exploration where we're told by so many masters of history that this is where our focus should be applied is rarely, certainly in the West, given any credence, and certainly nothing in the way of education.
How does it fit with you guys that this field of potential is around us, and through it we can manifest the things that we want? You know, we have desires, and this field is quite prepared to manifest them for us, but it's also there to help us let go of our egos. Now, when we have desires that are reinforcing our egos, you know, it will still manifest those things for us, but there's going to be a problem. There's going to be a cost involved, because we're forcing this field to go in a contrary direction to how it would like to move.
That sits pretty comfortably with me. I think that that's one of the reasons why the old traditions that Mr. C was talking about, and Buddhism and the rest, suggest the middle way, is because we are at the moment manifesting our own intent. It's just that it doesn't look like that. You know, we get a fair chance to blame it on other people or on circumstance. I think maybe because of the way time works, there's a kind of delay between our intent and the manifestation of the result. And it's my impression that the distance between those two things is ever decreasing, that the results of our intents are now manifesting pretty quickly. That's making it harder for us to ignore the fact that we are somehow responsible for what's going on. Which of course is another part of what's happening, isn't it? Taking responsibility is one of the big things that happens when you do realise that the environment is not entirely as it's been presented. And one of the things he's researching into on his internet is whether it's called, the book was called The Sense of Being Stared At. And it's something I know he's been working into for a long time, and I know that he's been doing that because he's been getting pretty good results and finds that many people do often know that they're being stared at, and you've got some professional experience of that, I gather.
Yes, I do. I could have been looking at somebody best part of a mile away, and they would turn around and look directly at me. Yeah, that's true. Many times.
Yeah, more times than you would have expected.
Yes, it sends the hairs on the back of your neck up.
And it's funny, isn't it, that this is exactly what I'm talking about. I think that in a world where there wasn't so much, electromagnetic noise, so much chattering in our own minds, so much distraction. I mean, when I go into cities, I'm absolutely astonished by all the moving billboards and just the stimulation. You know, in another time and another place, the person might actually know that they're being looked at and who's looking at them, rather than just because a mile away. That's pretty amazing, really.
Yeah, and it would be direct eye contact if that were possible. You know, they're actually looking directly at you, you know.
Yeah, and you see, this is exactly the sort of thing that certainly Rupert Sheldrake's talking about, is the fact that this is exactly part of the field, I think, that he's describing. And in The Science Delusion, one of the 10 creeds he puts forward for materialist science is that all unexplained phenomena, such as telepathy, are illusory. There's now ever increasing evidence that this is a valid idea, and I certainly don't think that Sheldrake would have found the time and the energy to spend so much time looking at it if there wasn't something in it. He also, of course, writes and investigates extensively into whether dogs know that their owners are coming home.
Absolutely.
And that has been, there's been some quite amazing videos involved in that study.
Yeah, you know, this is why Sheldrake has reached the ears of the listeners who are about to hear this. He has the facility on his site to do your documenting and verifying. You know, he's encouraging people to partake in these experiments on a scientific level of observing the results. You know, proving to yourself or disproving, perhaps, about the validity of these things that we're currently discussing. You know, Sheldrake is a scientist. He has a PhD. So this isn't someone just loosely speculating a theory. He's using science to validate it, and is currently conducting experiments that anyone can be a part of.
And I think that's an important thing, because it's bringing investigative science back down, back to where its roots are, really, which is with the enthusiastic amateur. You know, somebody who's genuinely trying to discover something rather than simply trying to spend some funding. And, of course, you get to be part of the results. You get to see what's going on in the experiments as a result. I've just remembered, I went on a Science, Matter and Consciousness course once, a three-week residential.
Oh,
and
right.
there was a chap there called Peter Fenwick, who he specialises, he deals with hospices, and he specialises in the dying and the actual, you know, the death part and the near-death part. He wrote a book called The Art of Dying, which is one of the most incredibly touching books I've ever read. But he had with him a dongle that you could stick into your computer, and it had in it a number of games which generated averages and means of one sort or another, and then put them up on the screen so that you could see them. So there'd maybe be a straight line across the middle of the screen with a parabola, a line, a curved line inscribed over the top of it, showing you where kind of on average you'd expect the information point to be. And by sitting and concentrating on this machine, you could actually make it go above or below the line. And if you've got a bunch of people to concentrate on it, you could make it go substantially above or below. And he had several little programs on this machine, and it could be set and left, and it would just busily generate its happy little average. And then once consciousness went and started playing with it, this would change. And I thought that was an amazing biofeedback thing for showing, you know, that we are reaching beyond our physical corporeal frame.
Absolutely. I mean, to my mind, it's in areas like this that a good portion of science should be deliberately steered, not steered around, as seems to be the case here, because it's only too easy for people to be dissuaded from looking any further into the lights of this if one mainstream science aired on mainstream media calls people delusional for investing time and energy in those areas of nonsense. Now, I don't know if you've seen the film Men Who Stare at Goats, which until I seen it fairly recently, thought was just based purely in fantasy and very, very loosely around anything that actually went on, where in actual fact the film itself is a little bit of a parody of the actual program that the United States military conducted and proved in enough instances there the validity of a lot of these mental sciences, shall we call them. So, yeah, you know, it is an area that we should focus our attention on from time to time and support Sheldrake out in his experiments and find out where the heck we're going with it.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. I think also by looking at the investigation into these little dogs, so even if they're their companion is a long way away and not in a place where they normally are, they get a random phone call and they've got a camera on the dog, and you can see it just get up straight away as soon as the guy gets up to leave to go and sit by the door. Now, the thing is, there's a level of consciousness being shown there that humanity is reluctant to allow in any other creature apart from human beings. You know, animals have to fight quite hard to find their way onto the kind of self-aware or list of conscious beings. And I think that if we realise that, I mean, what kind of vibrational connection is that when, you know, you stand up to go and your dog responds? And we know that plants are the same. We know that, you know, threatening one plant with a blow lamp can make the other plants in the room respond. It has been shown again and again. Mm. And if we were to realise that this is the true energetic connection that we've got with everything, we would surely be forced to be a little bit more circumspect and compassionate about the way we behave.
Yeah, you know, to accompany that, there really needs to be an evolutionary step in society at large, because if attention is drawn to the fact that things can be affected by the way we think about them, without the right foundation within society, of course, you are very likely going to have that abused by people that like to abuse things. And you know, maybe this is why it goes in cycles, because without something being either forced upon us, if that's the right way of putting it, or at least introduced to us through something outside of ourselves, then we're likely never going to get there, you know. Either way, I think it's really positive to have something not too far in the future to look upon as the potential for an event that may well see this this evolutionary societal step where people start to focus on things that matter. You know, the needs before the wants, and turn it around that way.
And to have no doubt that there's an ever-mounting tide of evidence to suggest that we're all personally implicated in and responsible for the way it's turning out.
Yeah, absolutely. If more people took that on board as a belief, you can just picture how quickly that would start to change life the way we see it being lived. If people were directed to think about their actions and how their actions have that ripple effect throughout the rest of their community. You know, if you look upon it from the idea that just your thoughts preceding your actions can have the same effect, then you're not going to be carrying out your daily existence the same as you would at the moment without such thoughts in your head. You know, surely it leads to something more beneficial.
I think that's quite right, and I think all of the people listening to TNS and many other people I meet are already familiar with that process, the process of realizing one thing, changing your behavior and noticing that it just washes on from there. I think I was quite encouraged as well by Sheldrake's statement that the sort of relatively, well, it's not a relatively modern idea, but the idea of holism, you know, that everything is an echo of everything else, that as above, so below, that on each scale we can see the same things working, that is the modern animism, he says, and points out that it is actually a road out of materialism, that as we pursue these ways, we're going to find our way away from the extremely expensive science that results on us spending, as they said, huge, unbelievable quantities of money on the genome project, only to find that it didn't actually serve any use to us as individuals. Instead of concentrating on, say, MMS, which appears to be a very simple formulation, which does a miraculous number of things.
And it's not as if they aren't concentrating on it. Just not in a very scientific way. You know, they are trying to shut down the science on MMS and dissuade people by calling it an industrial bleach, you know, which it isn't.
And that, of course, is the other amazing thing, isn't it, is that a lot of this is actually being achieved by, you don't even need to have the evidence or anything, it's just by putting the right suggestion into the press, that you can dissuade people from from looking into things like MMS and all the things that are helping to sort out people's cancers, at the same time as claiming that you've got sort of medicines that work, cutting in and cutting out now. Oh, I think I'm getting longer silences than
yeah,
I am.
You're back. Yeah, that was a long cut out, that one.
We might as well press on with it and see where we get to, because I was also, another thing that surprised me a bit about Rupert's comments were that when he was talking about, when he was talking to access to this kind of ancient animist culture or the modern holism, he mentioned that, you know, some people come to it through green approach, some through alternative or mystical experiences, and some through psychedelic experiences. Mm. So that's another interesting validation, because, you know, I think it is important to recognise when these alternative, what are apparently alternative ideas, are actually validated by somebody who's using the physical sciences methods.
Yeah, you know, the conversation that you've got between Sheldrake and Lipton, I think, is a fantastic way of introducing these men's minds to those that haven't heard them yet. It captures them on a really humanistic level while they're in the midst of their recountings of their points of interest. But the whole sphere of what we're talking about here, you can just imagine, you know, you go back to your scholastic days, how often were you given the opportunity to have such discussions with anyone in academia? Well, I don't know, actually. I've little understanding of your experience. All I can recount is mine and those I have had this discussion with, and you could write on your thumbnail the amount of information you'd have got from anyone in academia on any of this sort of subject matter.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that one of the things that obviously the work was going on, because I'm aware that the stuff about holonomics and memory and all of that has been going on for many years. But of course, now with the internet, we can get access to some of these people. And I think that the thing that strikes me now is that not only are there people out there who are willing to talk about it, but when you do meet them, they are absolutely fascinating. Rupert Sheldrake, I found a thoroughly absorbing person to listen to. And when I was on the consciousness course that I mentioned, I got David Peets was my teacher for 2 or 3 days, and he was a friend of David Bohm and knew most of the other fathers of modern physics. And so as a result, you get stories about their girlfriends and about what it was like, you know, messing around with them, and it makes it all so much more real somehow.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's on a human level. Often we see like a barrier between the world of science and the world of the average working citizen, if I can use that word. And what we have in areas like this are points at which the boundaries are at their thinnest, because it does generate, I think, for most people that hear these discussions, an interest within themselves to learn a little bit more about it, because it's an area that science can't really stamp any authority on because they've refused to look at it for so long.
And the place where that's becoming most apparent, of course, is with people's personal health and the way they look after themselves, because as Sheldrake said, complementary medicine springs out of these animistic cultures that believe that everything had a spirit within them. Mm. And the medical establishment is claiming, well, I'm not sure it ever does claim to be able to cure things, but it's certainly giving the impression that they're a good place to go to for that, whilst in fact the opposite, not only is the opposite true, that quite often people end up getting sicker, sometimes just as a result of the diagnosis, but that now there's ever clearer and clearer evidence that what the so-called complementary practices that come from these kind of visionary cultures are actually more effective. And that, again, has got to raise questions into people's minds. Well, how come the people who are getting all the money are coming up with one result and the people who are out there eating exotic plants in the jungles are coming up with another?
There you go. You know, a mutual friend of ours, Dave Murphy, who's about to launch himself out into the speaking circuit, dealing specifically with the topic of cancer, cites a really worthwhile and pausing for thought set of statistics in relation to the occasions, the documented occasions, that doctors in unison have gone on strike in any one particular area. Whenever this has happened, the death rates, the mortality rates in the areas that the doctors have gone on strike on have significantly fallen for the period of the duration of the strike.
You know, I remember hearing the same thing about the firemen. When the firemen were on strike, fewer things got set on fire.
So, and in addition, people that don't have any cancer treatments at all tend to last. What was it? He said, I think it was something like six years longer than if they have any treatment.
Amazing, isn't it? And I really, if people can become aware that they do have some kind of direct responsibility for what's going on, and that their consciousness is affecting what's happening, and they can become aware of information like this, it will surely start to make a difference. And I've been particularly struck over the last few months by the upswelling of information on cures for cancer.
Yeah, I mean, it's criminal. It really is an area of criminality. When you see the numbers of cancer charities out there that refuse to interview anyone associated with any of these so-called alternative cures.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, but they're all on the edge of a breakthrough, aren't they? They're all always on the edge of a breakthrough. Give us some more money.
That's right. Well, that was one of my favourite of Rupert Sheldrake's ideas, was this idea of promissory materialism, where he points out that they admit that they don't really know how the mind relates to the brain, or they don't know lots and lots of things, but that they will know in 10 years' time or so, and they keep just chucking the conclusions forward another 10 years and taking more money. And like he says, the promissory notes are wearing a bit thin with constant reissue now, and I'd say that it's not only that, it's the fact that we're lucky, I think, on TNS, but there are other places, to realise the myriad of these little breakthroughs that are arising all at the same time, you know, in energy, in nutrition, in complementary therapy, and in the law even to a certain extent. Almost everywhere we look, we're seeing individuals, nearly always an individual or two or three individuals who've managed to get themselves to the point where they're really making a difference to other people. And I'm sure it's that overall tide that's going to make the difference in the long run.
This time we'll be talking to a muted microphone.
All right.
So, well, yeah, you know, I mean, the fact that this is bringing up these sorts of conversations around Sheldrake and Lipton's own fields of speciality, I think, is testament to how important it is that these guys are heard more on the lips of others, because this is the area where we should be drawing attention to, you know, as well as withdrawing our energy from a system that we see ultimately operating on the principles of greed and depravity in certain cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lipton's phrase is that we're caterpillar consciousnesses looking out on a butterfly world, is how he describes it.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good way of seeing it. The fact that we do seem to be on the cusp of a change in the way we're going to be seeing things, by and large, I think, you know, I don't think this is just going to be something that's exclusive to those that actively discuss it, like we are doing now. I really do give credence to this morphic field and the ability to affect everything in it when the time is right. You know, it's a good thought to have, that you don't necessarily even have to be aware of this potential phenomena to experience its effect, its benevolent effect. And I think this is what we're going to be entering into in the not too distant future. It seems to be happening now, in fact.
I think that's right, because as we become aware that that the things we believe are not necessarily the things that we need to believe, it definitely changes the way you respond to everything. And I mean, the very basis of Lipton's and Sheldrake's work is say on this genetic level. I wanted Rupert to concentrate on those two plants, because one of the things we're constantly encouraged to believe is that it is our genes that are somehow programming our life. They're somehow responsible for building what goes on. And Sheldrake's quite clear that all they do is code for proteins. I mean, they are receiving a signal from somewhere, presumably, that tells them what to do, but they're not actually themselves thinking. And we refer to that, the single-celled organism, as a tiny little bit of DNA, and it's rootless, and that's all. And yet the plant will go on moving through several cycles for a few months before it'll actually die off. It's recycling its own protein so that it can grow bits, even though it doesn't have any nuclear DNA in it. That's fundamentally undermining more or less the entire research approach of modern medicine, just that little apparently innocent wee fact.
Yeah, you know, the science bit, as I understand it, in relation to the DNA, is that it's not the DNA itself, it's the protein coating on the DNA that supplies the receptors that allows the DNA to then be programmed with what the receptors of the protein is picking up, so that the DNA itself isn't what's driving the cell changes. It's the information being relayed to the DNA that's driving the changes. And that, for me, really is a good kick in the teeth to medical orthodoxy, where they are continually pointing the blame at faulty genes as being responsible for the manifestation of a lot of society's more recent nefarious symptoms. You know, asthma, cancer itself, you know. there's
autism.
Autism, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things there. Firstly, is one of the very first things that turned Lipton's mind was the fact that he had those three separate petri dishes of identical stem cells, and simply by changing their environment, the nutrients in which they were subsisting, he generated bone, muscle, and I don't know, nerve. There were three distinct sorts of material that were developed from identical cells. So that suggests that, you know, the genes just sit there waiting to find out what the environment's going to do. And the other thing is that I gather there's now some fairly major investigations into the nature of the cell membrane, you know, these little individual cells that have respiratory and immune systems and all of that, were thought to be surrounded by an impenetrable kind of membrane, and science came up with all sorts of potassium sort of ventricles to let stuff in, and pumps to get rid of potassium they didn't need, and then they found sodium in there, so they needed a sodium pump to get it in and out. And bit by bit, the whole thing became, as materialist science does, became unbelievably complicated. But it seems now to be more likely to be the kind of mechanism that you're describing around the DNA, a sort of protein sheath, if you like, which is itself sensitive all the way around. And it's not only deciding what's needed inside the cell and what needs to be kept outside, but the simple mechanism by which this is achieved is by, I'm not quite sure how it works, but there's a special sort of water in the human system. or in the sort of biological system, which hydrates and dehydrates these various chemicals, elements that are needed, and changes their size accordingly so that they can, as a result, they can kind of move through this intelligent protein around the outside of the cell. And that, of course, is exactly the way, like Lipton says, it's exactly the way the human reacts. He says that we've got whatever it is, billions of cells in our body. Every single one of them is effectively like an individual, like an individual organism, in that it does all the things an organism does. And that leads Lipton fairly quickly to the idea that we as humanity are a community of cells. And that's, and that at the moment we're not getting on too well.
yeah, I'd say that's a reasonable assessment. But, you know, what can we offer in the way of evidence to back up what we're talking about? You know, you could conduct your own experiment here, Nick. You could utilize the radio show to conjure up a verifiable experiment, just utilizing the listeners to the show. And your, how would you do this? You would have to put something in some sort of a virtual envelope that can be opened after the results are in. But I'm reasonably sure you could set it up.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it? To look at the way that sort of thing is done. I mean, to a certain extent, individuals are doing this, listening to that. I think it'd be very interesting to get something together with MMS. You know, to try and see just exactly what's going on there, because it seems to be having beneficial effects across the board, which ought to be, and in many cases it's doing it with people who have had some kind of professional diagnosis.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been an advocate of MMS for a number of years now, and of course we've got Reverend Rashes on the TNS site, who's actually a Reverend Doctor of MMS, having been to Jim Humble's training centre in the Dominican Republic and done the necessary there. You know, it's validated itself for me, but for anyone that's not aware of it, yeah, you know, the advantage you have in MMS is that, unlike having to have your blood tested to find out what your nutritionally deficient in, MMS will take on whatever pathogens are there as the result of a deficiency or an overexposure to or whatever. MMS will take out the cell wall thickness of the pathogens, which are just fractionally thinner than that of a healthy human cell, and the benevolent gut flora. MMS lies right between the healthy cell wall, which it can't affect, and the weaker virus and bacterial cell walls that cause harm to the human body. Its electrical makeup is just right that it will rupture the cell membranes of your pathogens whilst leaving the healthy human cells intact. The only issue that causes, of course, if you take too much too quickly, you will tend to experience a bit of a toxic overload, and the body's purgative processes as evidence of that. But if the protocols are adopted and followed, then it doesn't really matter what it is you've come down with. In this one product known as MMS lies your likely I don't know if cure is the right word to use here, but it'll certainly get rid of whatever it is that's threatening your homeostasis.
Yeah, and of course, one of the things that most convinces me of the fact that the MMS must be the right thing is the speed and viciousness with which orthodoxy seems to be trying to clear out the warehouses.
There you go. Yeah, you know, this 180 degree principle is showing itself to be the case in so many facets of this corporate construct that has a tight grip around the throat of the world at the moment. or maybe it always has, you know, just under different guises. But I'm certainly not in the least happy with life under the corporations, and you know, I feel sorry now. Feelings of resentment have pretty much left me. I generally feel sorry now for those still trapped firmly within it. You know, it's like they're inside a cell membrane that we've osmosised ourselves through to the other side of, and we can't seem to make contact with those still inside.
And I remember what it was like to be a bit like that as well. I mean, although I think I've always had a slightly alternative view to life, it did come as a bit of a shock to find the scale of what was going on, and to find that it still is. I mean, Lipton and Sheldrake are both fairly casual, really, about the state of science and its funding by corporations, but what they appear to be doing is making energetic progress in the other direction. They're not wasting their efforts trying to bring down.
Oh, he's dropped, hasn't he?
I can hear silence. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting the little dots on there.
Can you hear silence?
just on the other side of the coin, and the sort of traditional medical side, people are going off having these biopsies, etc. That's sort of fixing it in the history, isn't it? That's taking the measurement.
Yeah, I guess in one regard, you know, I suppose if symptoms are manifesting themselves, and you're noticing said manifestation, then you want to do something about it. The issue is when you put your symptoms in the hands of a profit-driven, pharmaceutically controlled medical system.
I think that's part of the problem. I think another part of the problem is that if, as Lipton suspects, we are actually the equivalent of a community of cells, then the disease that's being expressed in the community and the world around us is going to manifest itself in disease on the next layer down, which is our...
Well, you know, they say the process of cure is from above to below and from within to without. And the call's gone again. Yeah, so if the process of cure is seeing the transit of the disease state from within to without and from above to below, what are we seeing in the way of symptoms in society now? Is that disease leaving, or is that disease just entering?
I think I like to think it might be entering that that really fevered state just before things wake. You wake up in the morning and at last you're cool and calm again. And I mean, it does seem to me that in a way, where this third dimensional world we're living in, the actual level we're interested in, if you like, is the next level up, is the 7,000 million minds that are down here experiencing things, and the community of individuals, and the place where the level where the solution lies, the solution to the challenges, is perhaps at the cellular level, and maybe as much to do with light, I reckon, as it is to do with nutrients. And we find ourselves sitting in the level in the middle, you know, unable really to see either the one or the other, but we are manifestations of both of them.
Mm. Well, you know, just like the DNA's protein coating, with its little antennas that can penetrate through to the external environment to get a reading, perhaps that's where we are. Our receptors are going to be getting through to our consciousness rather than just our subconscious, and we'll consciously perhaps be starting to perceive some of these signals that, by and large, we've just not been aware of. And that manifests itself in, whatever way it's going to manifest itself in, awareness, I think, being the key.